From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. A high-profile trial of Joaquin Guzman Loera, the man better known as El Chapo, has begun in Brooklyn, New York. The notorious Mexican drug lord, whose Sinaloa cartel has been responsible for immeasurable brutality, violence, and deaths, was extradited for the trial from Mexico. Unfolding as part of the trial is also the immense corruption among Mexican government officials who have routinely accepted massive bribes from the cartels. It is fitting that El Chapo's trial begins at the same time that a refugee caravan from Central America traveling through Mexico is arriving at the U.S. border. Many among the refugees are fleeing the drug war and violence in their home countries. We turn to Joan Griot. He is an award-winning journalist and writer based in Mexico City. His books include El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency, and Gangster Warlords, Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and the New Politics of Latin America. He just published an op-ed in the New York Times entitled El Chapo Puts the Drug War on Trial. Welcome to the program, Joan.
Always good to be here.
Thanks for joining us. So this particular trial has been many years in the making, hasn't it? El Chapo has escaped prosecution. He has literally escaped from prison several times. What has built up to this moment where he is finally facing trial? And interestingly, facing it in the U.S., not in Mexico.
So, I mean, you could say going all the way back to the 1970s, El Chapo, in a video he recorded and gave to Rolling Stone magazine, he said that he first got involved in growing opium poppies in the mountains where he grew up when he was 15 years old. And he was born in 1957, so that would be around 72 or 73 in the early 70s. And there's a history of the Mexican drug trafficking growing since then. Around that time, 73 was when the DEA was first formed, and they had this long, decades-long combat and effort to get El Chapo. As you mentioned, two prison escapes. Since 2008 here in Mexico, about 119,000 murders, which are said to be related to the drug cartels or the security forces fighting them. Thousands have disappeared. Tens of thousands of people dying in the United States from heroin overdoses. So, I mean, epic scale.
So he is facing trial in the United States in a federal court in Brooklyn, New York. What are the charges that he is facing?
So he's facing 17 counts of conspiracy to traffic drugs and various kingpin charges. And this is part of the organized crime and the drug trafficking laws that have been created over the years to go after international drug traffickers, particularly Latin American traffickers. And one thing about these, it doesn't matter if he was in the United States or not. He's not accused of committing crimes on American soil. What he's accused of is running a criminal conspiracy to traffic drugs from Mexico to the United States, including tons of cocaine, tons of marijuana, tons of crystal meth, and tons of heroin. Now, they are mentioning various murders in this trial, but he's not actually charged with those murders in the United States. Those murders were committed in Mexico, and they are bringing up those murders to reinforce the arguments in court. Prosecutors talked about bringing up 33 murders, and the judge said you're bringing up too many. It's not a murder case, it's a trafficking case. But like I said, in Mexico, you're dealing with tens of thousands of murders related to this drug war over the years.
So I understand that so far among the testimonies of people testifying against him are a man named Jesus Zambada Garcia. He used to work for El Chapo. And in addition to the violence and the deaths that his testimony revealed, including hit on his own life, it was revealed that he was bribing government officials to the tune of $300,000 per month for more than a decade. So how does the case so far in a way, indict, if you will, the Mexican government and Mexican government officials.
Well, I mean, this is not really a surprise in Mexico. If somebody says drug traffickers were paying $300,000 a month to the Mexican government, I think the response to many people in Mexico would be, is that all? You know, only $300,000 is a lot more money made in drug trafficking than that. You know, this is no surprise. It's very open. The Mexican government has itself arrested many people for taking drugs, for taking bribes from drug cartels. You know, this is long known. I think what's interesting is when you highlight this in a court, in a federal court in New York, while the world is watching, you're highlighting the fact that the Mexican security services, the Mexican state apparatus is corrupt and at all levels. And this is, again, what both the prosecution and the defense are making, this argument that the Mexican government is corrupt, you know, at many levels. I mean, there's some arguments. Does it really go up to the president's office, or does it go up to cabinet level, or to generals, or how far does it go up? But widespread corruption is acknowledged. What you have to look at is, while it's acknowledged that the Mexican security forces are very corrupt, there have been allies with the United States in the war against drugs. And under the Merida Initiative, the United States has given billions of dollars to the Mexican security services in form of helicopters, wiretap gear, equipment, and so forth. So it's given equipment and support to security forces that are acknowledged to be corrupt and that have been accused of widespread human rights abuses. So that, again, looks at kind of one of the real problems and contradictions of the war on drugs that's been happening here in Latin America over the last few decades.
In your New York Times op-ed, you wrote, in terms of taking down kingpins and burning heaps of their narcotics, the drug war has been a stunning success. In terms of reducing the number of Americans killed from overdoses or Latin Americans murdered over smuggling profits, it's been a resounding failure. Is that failure by design?
I don't think so. I think you know, if you want to talk about a conspiracy theory or a mess up theory, I would go more with the mess up theory. I think if you look at the way, if you go back to Richard Nixon in the late 60s, early 70s, when he kind of began the war on drugs, and he talked about the complete abolition of drugs from American lives. You know, he really believed, I think he probably genuinely believed, that you could use the force of government to stop drugs being available to Americans. And, you know, I don't think he at that point envisioned that we'd be sitting here now talking about 120,000 murders in Mexico and 16,000 heroin deaths in the United States last year. He probably believed that. And then over the years, the DEA tried. They first of all, you know, arrested a bunch of dealers on the street and realized that didn't work. So then they started going after the kingpins. And then building very hard conspiracy cases against kingpins. And, you know, it's a machine that has kept on rolling. There are some interests there, obviously. I mean, there are the DEA is a bureaucracy which wants to keep alive. It can seize assets, which can make money from. There are, you know, when you move the Mexican military around Mexico to fight drug cartels, there are people who gain from that. There is a certain economy in fighting it. But I don't think really it's a big conspiracy. I think it's a stumbling policy that people haven't, that Washington and Mexico and internationally, we haven't managed to figure out a better way of doing.
Now, Guzman or El Chapo is not the first Mexican drug lord to be tried in the U.S. There have been previous extraditions, and you point out that in most cases, those are usually settled before there are actually any trials. But in the case of El Chapo, he pled not guilty to these trials that involve conspiracy and drug trafficking. This means the trial will likely go on for a long time, if he is convicted and, say, spends the rest of his life in prison, what effect will that have on the drug war? Does that mean that his cartel will disappear? Will stop selling drugs? Will there be any impact on the actual proliferation and trafficking of drugs and the violence associated with in Mexico and the US?
Tragically, probably not at all. And he was extradited the day before Donald Trump took power as president. There's a bit of a debate here in Mexico as to whether it was a kind of gift to Donald Trump so he wouldn't be so harsh on Mexico, or a gift to Obama to say, well, you've been good with us. There's a bit of a debate about that. But anyway, since he was extradited, he has lost his power, I think, from the prison in the United States to really affect things in Mexico. And initially, there was a turf war in Sinaloa among two factions of the Sinaloa cartel. One of them was run by some of his sons, who were known as Los Chapitos, and one of them by a former prison guard who helped El Chapo escape back in 2001 and then became a lieutenant to him, high up in his organization. And they had a big turf war for control of the cartel. Tragically, amid that turf war, a very good journalist and a friend of mine called Javier Valdez was murdered in Culiacán, Sinaloa. And the violence has carried on, the drug trafficking has carried on. I think the sons of Chapo seem to win that battle and consolidate control of the cartel. But another cartel called the Jalisco New Generation Cartel is also fighting. And the reality is that you have got an endless supply of people willing to step into the shoes of El Chapo or Pablo Escobar, or whoever the big drug lord is. America, according to a White House study, Americans spend $100 billion every year on crystal meth, marijuana, heroin, and cocaine. And as long as there's people spending that money and it's an illegal business, people will step in to do it. So I don't think El Chapo being in prison or Pablo Escobar being killed back in 1993 or so many other people being incarcerated is going to stop the drug trade.
So let's talk about the caravan of refugees. It's been called the migrant caravan. Others contend that it's really should be looked at as a caravan of refugees coming through Mexico from largely Central America, many of them citing the war on drugs and drug-related violence in their own home countries as a reason for the exodus. I know you've also written about that. Do you see, do you think that Americans understand enough how serious the violence is of the drug war and understand why that could lead to this exodus of people?
No, I don't think people do appreciate it. It's something I've been covering for many years and it's been a big, concern seeing this. In parts of Mexico, I saw this 10 years ago when I was in Sinaloa and I was covering the aftermath of a big massacre in a village. And everyone was leaving the village in a big caravan of pickup trucks. And they were running. They were so scared after this massacre. And I was like seeing refugees then thinking, wow, this really has gone beyond a situation of kind of cops and robbers to destabilizing parts of the country. And since then, we've seen a big increase in Mexicans in various parts of Mexico seeking asylum in the United States because they've run from very clear threats. Now, in Honduras, the situation is worse than in Mexico, and Honduras really is in a kind of state of collapse right now. Now, the violence is a big part of that. Drug trafficking is a major part of the violence in Honduras and drug trafficking into the United States. Honduras is a trampoline, a stopping point for the cocaine coming from Colombia to Mexico. It's also deeper than that. It is also a question of poor communities, corruption, extreme corruption in the government, and the spread of gangs and so forth. So it's a complicated situation. There does need to be thought about how you can deal with the root problems in these countries of violence. And they're not easy solutions to this. I think one thing we need to talk about more as well is the trafficking of firearms, of guns. I mean, the fact is that in Mexico, every other 15-year-old aspiring hitman can have an AK-47 or an AR-15, and they are largely coming from the United States. So we have to talk about that as well. Now, I don't want to say the problem is all the fault of America. These are problems of Latin American countries as well. But, you know, we have to look at the root causes and the deep problems, which could get worse in years to come.
I want to emphasize what you just said and repeat it because it's such a critical point. Essentially, the U.S.'s lax gun laws, gun purchasing laws, are enabling weapons to be smuggled across the border into Mexico and fueling the violence there, or helping to arm the cartel leaders and soldiers. This is incredible. I mean, and we here in the United States often as a society pretend we're utterly innocent in this drug war. So that's a really important point. Now, Mexico is seeing a huge leadership change, or at least it's, you know, might be a leadership change. Enrique Peña Nieto, the outgoing president, has, you know, had a very friendly relationship with the U.S., but been sort of, you know, with Trump, especially with Trump's talk of the border wall, there's been tensions. And now you have Andrés Manuel López Obrador, significantly to the left of Peña Nieto, coming into power soon. He won the election there. What do you expect any change when it comes to the drug war politics under AMLO?
I expect a kind of change, at least in style. López Obrador, for a long time, I mean, he ran for president three times. Before that, he was mayor of Mexico City with a very big platform. So he's been a very big player in national politics in Mexico for two decades. And for a long time, he really didn't talk about the drug war. I think he failed to address it for a long time. Even in the 2012 election, when it was crazy, I mean, I was covering things like 49 decapitated corpses in a place, and then the election debates, the politicians weren't talking about this issue. So I think it was, for a long time, he made a mistake of not addressing it. In this election, he did address it. I think that was part of the reason that he won. He did say, you know, we have to change things. We have to look at the way the communities are suffering and people are suffering. He has two main kind of strains of thought on this. One is that he kind of talks about peace and reconciliation, which is a nice idea, but it's hard to know what it will really mean in policy. I mean, he's talked in some ways about even an amnesty for certain criminals. I don't know if that's really workable. I think what they do need to do is really focus on prevention campaigns, on going to communities and working with young people and trying to stop them being recruited by cartels, often when kids are 12 or 13 years old. But another strain in his thinking is talking about much more unification in the security forces. Now, again, this is a valid point. I've actually witnessed shootouts between different police forces in Mexico several years ago. I was in Nuevo Laredo, and the federal police and municipal police began to exchange fire. So there does need to be more of a kind of a unification of police forces. He's talked about the bringing up an old figure called the National Guard and kind of bringing everyone together. But it's hard to know how workable that will really be. So we'll have to see how things go for him. I want to be optimistic and hope he can reduce the amount of death here, because it really is hurting many people, many families.
I want to turn back to what we started discussing, which was the trial of El Chapo taking place. It's already begun in New York. It likely drag on for a long time. Do you think that El Chapo because he's El Chapo, in a sort of scorched earth manner, would start to name drop those members of the Mexican government that are high up enough that it could destabilize the government with the incoming new president? I mean, he could be naming names of people that are deeply implicated in the corruption, right?
Well, his lawyer in opening statements already pointed fingers at the former and current presidents of Mexico. So he said, his lawyer said, Felipe Calderon, who ruled from 2006 to 2012 and really launched the militarized drug war, said he was receiving money, the current president Enrique Peña Nieto. Now,
so he said Calderon and Peña Nieto had been receiving money?
Yeah, he threw this out right away. Now, the presidents, both the ex and former president, denied this right away. Mm-hmm. It was amazing. It didn't have much impact in Mexico, because people kind of presume that could be true anyway. I think what would make a difference is if there was documentary proof. I think if El Chapo went on the stand and just said, I was giving money to the presidents, it wouldn't even necessarily hurt or destabilize things more than they're already so destable here. I mean, you've got governors on the run for drug trafficking here. You've got, you know, fields full of bodies. There's so many crazy things that have been happening here. Those kind of words won't make a difference. What would really make a difference is if documentary evidence was shown to say, here's a video, here's some kind of bank account proof to show that a bribe was paid. I think then, because then that would say, well, you then from then you should really prosecute or press charges against the president or the official receiving money. Unless that is brought up, I don't think words would really cause any more commotion than there is in Mexico. Mm.
Finally, Johan, I want to ask you what your opinion is on what seems to be a sort of glorification of drug warlords, especially in Hollywood. We've seen numerous television shows, you know, on like Netflix and other channels that have glorified Pablo Escobar, El Chapo. They have TV shows about him. You know, there's been a debate around whether these shows are exposing what's happening or romanticizing these drug warlords. Do you have an opinion?
Well, I think human beings have always written stories, told stories about wars and conflict, even when they're happening. If you go back to the Iliad or like the Crusades or all the time, you know, there's stories were told about these wars and conflicts happening. So I think the concept in itself, I haven't got a problem with that. Having seen this personally, I mean, if you were really to tell this story, it would kind of be a very dark, you know, more realistically, it would be a very dark, tragic story. If you were to really show the mass graves, the kind of scenes of mothers crying when their kids are dragged away and killed, it probably wouldn't be such popular viewing on Netflix. I think there's bigger things to worry about than what TV shows are doing. I've been more concerned about looking about where the guns are coming from, about, you know, I mean, I do think there is a battle for hearts and minds of the young children being recruited by cartels. But then I think this is more about being on the ground. I mean, you know, I think, you know, a kid can grow up probably in the suburbs of Seattle or you know, in a European city or in a wealthy background in Mexico and maybe not be bought into, watch the same films, listen to the same music and not be bought into crime. But there's other reasons if people are, you know, are more marginalized, if the drug traffickers are operating in their neighborhood, that really bring them there. So I think the social work is very important.
Will El Chapo ever see a justice for the deaths at his hands?
If he's convicted in the US court, he'll, you know, he's 61 years old. He's likely never to be released from a US court. So from a US prison. So he'll likely be in American prison for the rest of his life is the most likely outcome. If he somehow beat the charges and was then extradited to Mexico to face charges here, they could then like deal with the murder charges.
And I mean, maybe escape again from a Mexican prison.
Yeah. I mean, justice is a hard word to talk about when you think about, I mean, not just El Chapo, the whole situation. I mean, you know, when I've personally seen mass graves with 250 bodies, which are unearthed next to housing areas where kids are playing, and the smell of corpses is going to where kids are playing. I mean, how you know, when you talk to mothers whose innocent sons have been dragged away by a bunch of guys in ski masks with guns, I mean, how are you going to really give justice to that? What does it really mean? Or should we be looking for a better solution and trying to avoid this violence? And it's hard to be covering this. You really hope that there'll be a better way found. And it's over the years, it seems to be going around in circles, but you have to keep hoping.
Well, Johan, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll link to your website, johangrio.com from our site. Thanks so much.
Always good to be here. Thanks much.
Johan Griot is an award-winning journalist and writer based in Mexico City. His books include El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. The newest book is Gangster Warlords, Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and the New Politics of Latin America. We've been talking about the trial of El Chapo in New York. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and now on Instagram at RU with Sonali.